The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Our guest has been referred to by Jelani Cobb as a Dean of American Journalism. Charlene Hunter Gault has chronicled some of the past half century's most important moments in Black life, culture, and politics. After desegregating the University of Georgia with Hamilton Holmes in 1961, she went on to become a trailblazing journalist, writing for The New Yorker and The New York Times, where in 1968, she established the paper's Harlem Bureau. Also a broadcast journalist, Hunter Gault served as a reporter and anchor for PBS's McNeil Era NewsHour, as NPR's chief Africa correspondent, and the South Africa bureau chief for CNN. Her many honors include two Emmy Awards and two Peabody Awards. Ranging from the civil rights movement to Barack Obama's presidential election and beyond, her new book, My People, is a compilation of her reportage and commentary that explores the Black American experience. Tonight, Ms. Hunter Gault will be in conversation with Dorothy Roberts, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. She is also a founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society in the Center for Africana Studies, and the author most recently of Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World. What a pleasure to have them both back. Please welcome Charlene Hunter Gault and Dorothy Roberts to the Free Library.
Well, such an honor to be able to speak with you about your fantastic book, Ms. Hunter Gault, and may I call you Charlene?
Yes, please.
Okay, all right.
Or you can call me Grandma.
Well, I'm a grandma too, so we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
I just, as I was saying before backstage, I adore this book. And one of the things I love the most about it, as evidence in the name My People, is that it's a book that is about Black people and that raises us up, that doesn't ask what's wrong with us, you know, that asks what's great about us, that looks at the bonds that we have with each other, but also our common humanity with every other people of the world. Those two aspects, I think, are so beautiful and so often overlooked in discussions about race. Also, you touch on so many different aspects of Black people's lives, from literature, art, film, television, politics, history, education, criminal justice, voting rights, of course. So many aspects which you've been chronicling for five decades. So one first question is, why did you decide to put it all together in this book now?
You know, at 80 years old, you forget things. And I've been trying to figure out, why did I decide to put this book together? And honestly, I really haven't figured it out. Maybe somebody suggested it. And maybe it'll come to me in the middle of the night one night and I'll touch my husband and wake him up and say, guess what I just realized?
Yeah.
But the more I worked on it, the more I started to think that, in a sense, one of the reasons I did it was when I wrote about South Africa, for example, I said, there's more to South Africa than the four D's: death, disease, disaster, and despair.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, even today, you look at the media, which is somewhat expanding and being a little bit more inclusive, but for years, we've been portrayed sometimes well and sometimes accurately, but not generally that way. And so the more I thought about it, and I chose twice as many pieces that are in the book, and my editor called me one day and said, okay, enough, enough. But there were just wonderful times that among our people, but also, you know, it's primarily about people of color, black people. But there are some wonderful stories. I was looking at the story about the civil rights movement the other day and about Rosa Parks. And one of the people, one couple who befriended Rosa Parks, one of them went was her lawyer and one went to take her home after she, you know, got out of jail. They were white. And so there are people who are my people who are not all people of color. And they're also in the book. Lucy and Sheldon Hackney, for example, who she, Lucy was the daughter of the person who took Rosa home. So, you know, it's predominantly about black people, but it's about our people. Maybe I should have called it our people. Well, maybe that's the next book.
Okay, okay. But as I said, it's both about us as black people, our bonds, but the, our common humanity with others, which, is a beautiful aspect of the book.
Thank you.
Yeah. So as I said, there's so many different aspects of this book, but one that really stood out for me was what you write about schools and education, and not just schools as the you know, the institution, but teaching in general, which can come in a lot of different forms. And you are concerned in the book about how black children will learn about their history and their culture. And you write that in your book, To the Mountaintop, you would hope that it would help young people, all young people, right, understand that there is no progress without struggle, as Frederick Douglass put it.
Right.
And so I wondered if you'd say something about the importance of teaching to you, because it comes through in so many pieces of writing in this book.
Well, it's really very important, which is one of the reasons I get so upset these days when I hear people trying to shut out some of our history, if not all of our history, because growing up in the segregated South, I my grandmother used to read three newspapers a day. She educated herself. And she, when she would drop down the paper, I would grab the funny papers or the comics or whatever you want to call them. And I fell in love with the comic strip character Brenda Starr. And we later learned that while the racism that extended to white people too and the sexism, she couldn't identify herself who she really was because she was a woman writing this comic strip. And as it turns out, years later, she was able to, they were able to say who it was. And so when I said to my mother in the segregated South, I want to be like Brenda Starr when I grow up. My mother didn't say, oh, no, little black girls can't do that. She said just very, like she always spoke, if that's what you want to do. And that was all the inspiration I needed. But thanks to our black segregated schools, there was a consciousness about our history. And so although my first role model was Brenda Starr, in my all-black segregated school, I learned about Ida B. Wells. And Ida B. Wells was a progressive activist, journalist. She was all over the place. And so one of the conclusions I've come to as I have looked at our history is that our history is our armor. Our history helped us survive so many awful things and yet come out whole, in a sense. I mean, some of us didn't make it, of course. But I think that the history that I learned growing up in the segregated South was like the history your mother and father learned and others before them. They knew that we could overcome. And so while there were awful things that happened to us, there was the mentality from our history of armor that enabled those who, like John Lewis, who proposed good trouble, getting in good trouble, and so many others who had that armor so that no matter what happened to them, like John, you know, took the first blow for freedom when he was on the trying to help desegregate the interstate bus lines. And by the way, again, when they were leaving Washington, D.C. to go on that, it was black and white, men and women, and so committed were they to challenging this segregation. They understood that it was potentially dangerous. So they all signed their wills before they left D.C. And all of them got on the bus, and eventually some of them made it and some of them didn't. But it, again, it was this consciousness from our history that we, they would overcome whatever confronted them.
Well, that leads me to want to ask a difficult question. This is the expert journalist.
No, this is the 80-year-old who can't hear. Oh.
Anyway, thank you. Kind of a difficult question. I think people have pondered this, but it comes out of what you were just saying and your history, which is that, as you point out, your education in the segregated South gave you an armor, taught you about your history. Another metaphor you use that I think is so fascinating is the invisible tiara that you had. Maybe before I ask my question, you could explain what the invisible tiara was.
Well, I mentioned my elementary school where I began to learn more about black people who had done amazing things in spite of the system that saw promoted separate and unequal. I said that the other day, and my husband said, no, it's separate but equal. I said, no, but it was separate but unequal. But my school in Covington, Georgia, was, of course, segregated in the early 50s and 40s, that is. And every year, they would have a fundraiser to make up for the deficits, to make up for the hand-me-down books that had pages torn out from the white schools. And my mother and grandmother, my father was in the military, and so I was predominantly reared by them, and they would go all over Covington, Georgia, especially to the various girlfriends of my uncle, who I don't think knew each other, but they would contribute. And whichever family raised the most money, their son or daughter would be king or queen. This particular night, I'm looking at my mother and grandmother, and they're over in the corner opening up their little handkerchiefs where they had folded in the nickels and pennies and dimes and quarters. And finally, they announced, and this year, our queen is Charlene Hunter. Well, I got a bull of a watch, which I didn't really care that much about. I mean, we had a little money because my father, as I said, was in the military, so that didn't knock me out. But the diamond tiara, I really liked. And I wore it day after day to the extent that my classmates started saying, you know, you got to get rid of that thing. It's getting on my nerves. And so finally, they were threatening me. And I said, okay, I'll take off the tiara. But I realized that the notion that I was a queen took up residence in my head. And so when I walked onto the campus of the University of Georgia, and the white students who didn't want me in Hamilton Homes there were yelling ugly things, including the N-word that was very popular at the time. When they were saying the N-word, go home, I was looking around for that person because I knew that wasn't me because I was a queen. And I had to let them know. So I tried to carry myself in that way. And I knew that I was wearing a crown. I knew who I was. And also, no matter what I was called by anybody, I identified myself with my history and with those who had struggled, like my mother and my grandmother and the teachers at the at our school and our preachers, because I'm a PK, that's the preacher's kid. I know most of you don't know, but some people say, well, what is that? It's a PK. But in our churches, in our schools, everywhere we went that was supposed to help us feel inferior, we're doing just the opposite. Now, that didn't help everybody survive because the system was horrendous. It still is. But it helped many of us get over.
Well, in answering the question about the invisible tiara, you answered the question I was going to ask about this. Maybe we'll call it a paradox of how you fought to desegregate schools. And of course, you desegregated the University of Georgia, which I read in your book was founded in the 1700s. And until you were enrolled, it had never admitted a black student.
But despite the fact, that it was a state school, and our parents' taxes helped support it.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, no, that's an important point. And so you were able to desegregate this. You fought for desegregation, but also the segregated school system gave you the armor and that invisible tiara that allowed you to do it. And
exactly.
It's an interesting complexity, let's put it that way, of the book. So I think I saw, and did I see the 5 minute?
No,
not yet. You see, it may be your ears, it's my eyes that are bad. So between the two of us. Well, oh, good, I'm glad, because I have several other questions to
ask. I'll try to be briefer.
No, it's wonderful, wonderful. So you spent 17 years in South Africa. That was also, I hadn't realized, I suppose I knew, but it hadn't sunk in that you were there for that long. And you chronicled the everyday life of people in South Africa, just as you had people in the United States. And you titled part four, A Single Garment of Destiny, borrowing from Dr. Martin Luther King's words from a letter from a Birmingham jail. And when I read that, I thought, well, King was probably talking about the single garment of destiny among people in the United States, and you took it to a global level, which is a fascinating dimension of your work and also this book. And can you just say something about why it was important for you to spend that time in South Africa, and also what you saw as the commonalities, what you mean by the single garment of destiny in relation to South Africa?
Well, I think that thank you, as they say on television today, these days, thank you for the question. You know, I was in Washington, D.C. when a group of people, including Eleanor Holmes Norton and congressman from D.C. now, and a great history of her own. But they used to picket outside of the South African embassy trying to identify with South Africans who, like us in the Jim Crow era, mm-hmm. were trying to get rid of apartheid. Mm-hmm. And so at a certain point, I said, you know, I need to go to South Africa and see the differences and the similarities. Mm-hmm. And I went first in 1985 when we, media, were considered enemies as much as the black people who were trying for their freedom. Mm-hmm. And it's always been my, shall I say, my effort in journalism to talk to all people mm-hmm. who might not have the ideas of or might not support the things I supported mm-hmm. personally. But I wanted to know from the black South Africans how they were carrying on mm-hmm. and hope to carry on mm-hmm. and hope to end apartheid. But I also wanted to talk to those who supported apartheid. Mm-hmm. They were all white, of course. Mm-hmm. And so I did. Mm-hmm. I talked to a winemaker. I later became a winemaker myself, which I no longer am, but it was a fun time. And so by the time Nelson Mandela was released, I had developed relationships, friendships with people who were fighting apartheid. Mm-hmm. And so when he was released, every journalist, I think, in the world mm-hmm. flew into Johannesburg to interview Nelson Mandela. But because I had kept up my relationships with the African National Congress people, everybody got 10 minutes. I got a half an hour. So I said, well, I want to be last. Mm-hmm. But he had, you know, here's a man who'd been in prison 27 years. In a whole different era. Mm-hmm. And so I watched the others interviewing him one after the other, and he sat very regally answering the questions. So then it came my turn. Mm-hmm. And I said to the people I had gotten to know, look, this man has never done television before. He's been at it all afternoon. I know it's getting late. But could we take a break so he could have a cup of tea? They were a little surprised by that, but mm-hmm. they were gratified. Mm-hmm. So they took him in, and he had his cup of tea. And then he came out and sat down. And I wanted to distinguish myself from the others. Mm-hmm. So I said, Mr. Mandela, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I said, I come out of the American Civil Rights Revolution. And I was about to tell him, he said, oh, do you know Miss Maya Angelou? Okay, can I tell you a secret? I didn't really know her personally, but I knew her work.
Yes.
And so I said, oh, yes, Mr. Mandela, he said, and before I could go on with that, now, let me just depart and say that everybody there was looking for a scoop, mm-hmm. including me. So he said, I said, oh, yes, sir, I know Maya Angelou. And he said, well, we read all of her books while we were in prison. I said, scoop! It was just wonderful, and it opened such a door that every time I was in his presence, mm-hmm. which was usually press conferences and things, mm-hmm. he always called on me. Mm-hmm. Now, to be sure, you know, like segregation, apartheid didn't quite end, although he had hired, to try and bring people together, he had hired one of the apartheid people mm-hmm. As an assistant. Mm-hmm. And while she did everything in the world for him, I have to say that, she did not like me. because no matter what was going on, if Madiba saw me, he would come and we would have our thing and she would try to separate us, and that wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So one day, I think it was his 80th birthday, and we had been told, the media, that we could not ask any questions. We could be there, we could film him, because they had brought some children who were handicapped to be with him and so forth. So, and it was his, I think, fifth or sixth anniversary, wedding anniversary to Graça Michelle. So again, the person I'm talking about was standing over there, you know, keeping everybody in check. So Madiba says a few words when he comes out, and we're like this, in a semicircle, the media, and he had to walk from here past us. Well, I was about the second person. So when he gets to me, I said, oh, Madiba, how's it feel to be, I
guess, you asked
80?
A question.
And he said something very brief, and she's looking at me like, I'm going to get you after this. And then, I mean, I was empowered at that point. So I said, and how's it feel to be married for to Graça Michelle for 6 years? And he stopped and he said, young lady, in our country, we do not ask personal questions like that. Well, everybody had something now that they could use.
Right, right.
Man, if she could have wrung my neck that day, she would have. But it was just wonderful, because just before he was to take office as president, I had another scoop interview, and we sit down, but I was very sad, because although I had a scoop, my son, Chuma, was graduating from Emory University the same day that Madiba was being sworn in. And I said, Mr. Mandela, I have to tell you something that's giving me a lot of pain on the one hand. I said, but my son is graduating from Emory University the same day that you're being sworn in, and I have to be in Atlanta. Before I could even finish the sentence, he said, of course you have to be there. You can interview me anytime. And he meant it. He meant it. Anytime I wanted to talk to him, he was available. But, you know, I don't necessarily think it was me. It's just that I don't know what it was, but I was open and he was open. And I think actually, when he got out of prison, I saw this in a picture I had forgotten about. He traveled to the United States, and I was with the Council on Foreign Relations, and we had a session with him, and they asked me to do the questions. And afterwards, as we walked out, I saw the picture yesterday. We were walking down the street hand in hand, I said, okay, scoop.
I'm sure it had something to do with you. He sensed something, I believe, about your journalistic talents and style. And that's what I want to ask you about now. Turning to journalism, and not just your long career, but your approach to journalism. It emanates from every page in the book, and there were several things that stood out. One that really stood out was that you do have stories about interviews with the most celebrated people in the world, like what you just told us about your ability to interview Nelson Mandela over and over. It's just fascinating. But you also write a lot about ordinary people, your school teachers, your grandmother, and someone on the corner of Harlem. You know, I love that chapter on the corner.
Yeah.
And not only do you write about everyday people and their everyday lives, but you really zoom in close so that you feel like we're in their living room, we're in their kitchen, we're on their street corner. And something else I noticed that's very striking, you have their voices liberally in every piece you write. We can hear, it's so striking compared to a lot of journalism where it's writing about an event, but you don't really feel like you're there. And in your writing, you have such a strong sense of the people you're writing about, partly because you take us into their world, but also you give us their voices, which I'm sure you had to elicit from the questions you asked them, right?
Right.
So I just wondered if you'd say something about your style of journalism and the importance of bringing out the voices of everyday people.
Well, thank you for your lovely compliments. Mm-hmm. I'll take them.
Just describing.
And I'll quote them somewhere.
Just describing what is in this book, but go on.
Well, you know, that I started that at the New Yorker and went on to do that at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And when I was hired by Arthur Gelb, some other black reporters had said, you know, you're now in New York, in New York. You should go and talk to Arthur Gelb about working at the Times. So they set up an interview. And at one point he said, now let me ask you this. If someone who was a friend of yours in Harlem had done something bad and I sent you up there to cover it, would you be able to tell the story?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it would depend. And he sort of sat back. And I said, because so many times black people are accused of something that they didn't do, mm-hmm. or there was some element to it that didn't come out. I said, so I would be able to tell the truth, mm-hmm. but it would depend on what the truth was, mm-hmm. that I needed to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, I mean, part of it is because of our current economy, but part of it is the ongoing racism. But we have people who are committing crimes and they're people of color. So you have to write about that. But you also need, I think, in so many of these instances, to put some of those things into context.
Yes, yes.
And that's what gradually, I think, some mm-hmm. in the media are trying to do. I have my own issues with the media currently, some of it, but I think that I was able, after a certain point, having gone up and down Harlem and back down to 43rd Street, where the New York Times was at then, and I finally said to Arthur Gelb, the editor, why don't we just establish a Harlem bureau, and I live up there and do my work up there? And he thought about it and eventually agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people I had come to know was a lawyer who had an office on close to the Apollo Theater. Probably many of you know about the Apollo. And his office was on the second floor overlooking 125th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a small room that was empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him if I could put the Harlem Bureau of the New York Times
wow.
in his office, because I could also go to him and say, what about this? And he would know because he had been there longer than
mm-hmm,
I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to look out at 125th Street and see the street corner preachers going all the way back to Marcus Garvey
yeah.
and all the way up to Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
And then a block over was Louis Michaud's bookstore, which at the time had the largest collection by and about black people. Now, there are others now that have those too. But in those days, I think he was one of the few, maybe one or two. And all kinds of writers, black, white, all colors, Trinidadian. I remember Trinidadian who used to go there all the time to do research. And I used to go there and just walk around. And one day I decided to do a piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was actually for the New Yorker. And one of the things I included in the piece, he loved to speak in couplets. Mm-hmm. He was about this tall, and he would just be running around. And one of his favorite couplets was, "The white man's dream has turned to sour cream." Now this was, but it was joyful. It was funny, yeah, you know. And yeah, there were white yeah. men and women in there, and they thought that was funny too.
Yeah, right.
But being in the community was critical, because while I don't have any of those ugly stories in there, because there were some, mm-hmm. it was a different side of my people. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, the editors at the New Yorker and the New York Times and other places I worked, I think, began to see something they hadn't seen. And also, it was bringing in people to their publications mm-hmm. who may or may not have been in their publications.
Yeah.
And, of course, there came a time when we had to sue the New York Times for discrimination against both women and black people. And mm-hmm. I think not long ago, it came back again. Mm-hmm. They've sued them again. Because you have to keep on keeping on. You can't establish good things and right things and then watch them go away.
Yeah.
You have to, as King used to say, keep on keeping on. That's why I have hope, because there's so many people today like yourself. And those of you in the audience, I don't know why you all are here. I might want to interview you afterwards. but there are people who understand that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And we have to keep on working towards a more perfect union.
Yes.
I'm for that. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to do anything else. Now, at my age, I don't know if anybody wants me to do anything else.
Yes, we do.
But here I am, so here we go.
Thank goodness. Well, that is a perfect way to end this part of the program. And I think you have given the audience a taste of the richness of this book. It's so refreshing. So refreshing and so needed now. So now's the time we're going to turn to you all to ask your questions of Ms. Hunter-Gault. And there are people with microphones, so they will approach you, and please speak into the microphone, and you'll be able to ask your question.
Hi, I appreciate you so much. I have a question. When you were like 17 and 18 and you and your family were deciding where you were going to college, it might be Mandela, it's too personal, but what happened in your family? What was the discussion and what was the, whole process there?
Thank you for the question. There was no discussion. And my family didn't have anything to do with that decision. In fact, I think the Brown v. Board of Education decision came down in
1954, 55.
And nothing in Atlanta, I was living in Atlanta at the time, had changed. And so a group of black activist men, doctors, one was a professor at Clark College, and one was a medical doctor, and I forget who the others were. They'll kill me if I said that, so I'm going to go look them up again. But anyway, they came to my school, and they said to the principal they wanted to test the Brown decision. And did he have two good students who might be willing to do that? Mm-hmm. Well, right out of his head came Hamilton Holmes, who was at the top of the class, straight A's, and I didn't have straight A's because I wasn't very good at math and still am not, which is why I'm married to a banker. but he brought us in and said, we're going to go downtown to Georgia State and we'd like to see if you would be interested in applying, which would begin to test the Brown decision. So we said, yeah, sure, why not? And so we go down, and Hamilton and I looked at the curriculum at Georgia State. And Hamilton said, I give him credit, although I rarely did. He said, there's nothing here I'm interested in. This is not going to prepare me. He wanted to be a doctor. His grandfather was a doctor. He said, this is not for me. And, of course, I'm not going to let Hemp get ahead of me. I said, yeah, I agree, too. I don't see anything that's going to help me be a journalist. And then Hamilton, I have to give him credit, God rest his soul, walked out on the porch, the deck, and said, I want to go there, and pointed north, which was, of course, the University of Georgia in Athens, north of Atlanta. I wasn't going to let him get ahead of me, so I said, yeah, me too. And the men couldn't say no, although they knew nothing about Athens, and they knew that if we stayed in Atlanta and there was actions against us, they could protect us. But they didn't know anybody in Athens. Moreover, between Atlanta and Athens, about 70-some miles, were homes of the Ku Klux Klan and all kinds of people. But how could they say no? Here we were being so enthusiastic about going north. So anyway, they worked it out. And that was how we began. Now, again, to your question, which I'm taking too long to answer, I'm sorry. Our parents, my father, again, was still in the war, so my mom said, okay, and they began to work out a situation where they could help protect us in the application, and we went. And, of course, that led to almost two years of legal back and forth. And one of the people in the book is Constance Baker Motley, who was just such a wonderful role model, and Horace Ward, Vernon Jordan, and Donald Hollowell. And they never missed a beat attempting to get us in, and were finally successful. I have to tell you one quick thing.
Sure, go ahead.
She was so focused on this case. She was fighting racism all over the South, but this was a very important case. And I, in her, as far as I could see, didn't exist. I was the plaintiff, but she never said anything to me. She was so good. I remember at one point, and I think it's in the book, she was so good at questioning these people who were lying about why we were being discriminated against. Somebody was heard to say when she was asking one of the officials at Georgia a question, he said, look at that guy sitting on that platform, says, he doesn't even realize that a curveball is coming that's going to knock him off his chair, which it did. But every day at lunchtime, she would eat lunch with Hollowell and Horace and wouldn't acknowledge even my presence, which I didn't even think anything about. And then came the end of the week when we thought the case had been made. I was going to go back to Wayne State where I had enrolled temporarily. And let's see, I guess Hamilton was just going to go back to Atlanta, which was 70 miles from Athens. But the Georgia officials, I think as a part of just sticking it into us, said we couldn't leave. We had to be there the following week. Well, I was 19, and I liked parties, and I wanted to go back to the parties that were the Christmas parties at Wayne, which was so much fun. And so I was in a funk. So I get in the car to go back to Atlanta, and Attorney Motley was coming in the same car. So she gets in the car, and I'm expecting her to be as she had always been, which was to ignore me, except as the plaintiff. I'm sitting there with my mouth poked out and boo. And she said, all of a sudden, as she took off her shoes because she had problems with her ankles and stuff, she said, in a voice I had never heard, "I know how you feel."
What?
She said, "You know, I was looking forward to going back to New York to be with my husband mm-hmm. and son." Her son mm-hmm. was 9 at the time. Mm-hmm. She said, "But I got to stay here." She said, "So I guess we just have to do what we got to do." Well, mm-hmm. you talk about being happy as a clam. Constance Baker Motley acknowledged yeah. my presence. Boy, that was better than me winning the case. Almost, not quite. But it was it was an amazing time. But back again to your question, the decision was Hamilton and mine. And mm-hmm. Even though there were those who attempted to desegregate a white college, Hamilton and I made those decisions. But mm-hmm. why? Our history.
Yeah.
It was in our blood.
Right.
It was a part of our, it was a part of our armor.
Yeah. Yes.
We had learned it from our history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so important today to continue to have our young people, black, white, Asian, whatever color, mm-hmm. Native Americans, mm-hmm. know that history.
Yes.
Because it will be their armor.
Yes.
Even when they come up against things that are challenging,
mm-hmm.
which today they are,
mm-hmm.
by every measure, today, people of color are the worst off in these terrible times.
Mm-hmm.
Every measure, and I keep looking at them,
mm-hmm.
and they are the worst off of any group in this country, mm-hmm. although everybody's suffering, to be sure,
mm-hmm.
no question about
mm-hmm.
it. I need to get an epidural. The first time I could get one was 2 months from now,
mm-hmm.
because there's so many sick people.
Yeah,
and I go to, I have to say, some of the best doctors in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the time and space. So if I can't get
yeah.
an appointment
right.
with a specialist, what about people who are not in my position?
Yeah.
Who don't have any insurance? Who may not even know what's wrong with them?
Yeah.
On the way over here, I saw a blanket at the bus stop. And I looked and I said, "That's not an empty blanket. Somebody's lying under that blanket."
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that? No matter what, and I've traveled a lot in recent days and weeks and months, and they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And many of them are people who had jobs, but the jobs don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to write another book.
We'll look forward to it. And another question, yes.
You just answered my question because I wanted to ask you about our young folks and the fact that they're not learning history in school, and what does that do for them? Let me say a few things. One is, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I just happen to be in Philadelphia visiting my 100-year-old grandmother. I don't know that much has changed between Atlanta and Athens even today. I'm not so sure about that. So that's one thing. But the other thing I really wanted to have you ask you to speak on are young folks who, I listen to you. You learned reading and mathematics and science in school, but you also learned learned confidence. You learned how to hold yourself together regardless of what you faced. And you said you were able to do that because of the history that you learned. Our young people are not learning history. They don't know history. Some young folks think Martin Luther King was married to Rosa Parks. They don't know history, and that's just recent history. So I wanted you to speak, like, what can we do? How can we inspire our children? What can we give our children so that they can stand up and square their shoulders and face whatever is coming their way? Because a lot is coming their way. So if you could speak to that, I would appreciate it. And, you know, take your time, because I could listen to you all day long.
Yes. She said, take your time. We could listen to you all night.
I got a plane to catch.
No, I got the whole night. So anybody don't want to go to bed, I'm with you.
Well, first of all, let me thank you for those questions. But let me also say that I was watching the news tonight, and I was looking at the reports about the politics in Georgia. Now, some of it is disgusting. I won't say who or what, but you can figure that out. He went to the University of Georgia, but I didn't say who. But you say nothing has changed, but something has changed. Because you have some incredible people running for office. I met Stacey Abrams when she was coming to the Vineyard to get some history or whatever from Vernon Jordan, who was still alive at the time. And I was at the airport, and she got off the plane, and I was waiting for Congresswoman Norton, who was spending some time with me at the time. And I went up to her, and I said, oh, I'm so happy to meet you. She said, I know who you are. Wow, that blew me away. But I don't know what's going to happen in this election. But look at Atlanta. Look at the number of black mayors who were elected to run the city. And they did very well. Now, you know, you have some who didn't do that well. But they were elected by people who had to be both black and white. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they couldn't have made it. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a piece for an organization that did a thing called Black Women Unmuted. It was a video. And at the time, the mayor was in deep black woman, deep trouble with so many of the young people, because they didn't like how she had treated the homeless downtown. I think she had moved them out and had them go somewhere else. I forget all the details. But the thing that so impressed me for that piece and in general was, even though she was not well liked by the younger people in the city, they didn't want her to speak, to do the graduation address at Spelman. They had just protested up and down and had looked for several different black women to come and do the talk, none of whom were available. So in the end, they had to take her. Well, she got up there and she said, I know that, there are problems with me being here. But she went on to talk about her own history. And at the end, she named all of the women who had been invited instead of her. And she talked about their contributions to people like them, young people like them, and how she hoped that in the future they would remember whom they had asked, who they had asked, and re-invite them. I just thought that was so, what's the word I want to use here?
Gracious, so, gracious.
What?
Gracious.
That's a good word. Thank you. All of these are editors in here. No, I thought it was wonderful. And so I want to give Atlanta some credit for all the black mayors they've had. Now, I don't know how this current vote is going to come out. It may not come out the way some of us would like it to come out in every way, but we're going to have to deal with it. And if the person who may get the position is elected, it's going to be up to people like you to make him do the right thing. If he's elected, he's elected. But you have to keep on keeping on, and as they say in South Africa, pressurize him to do the right thing. Now, that's not to say he's going to win, because I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, in the event that, mm-hmm. we still have work to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Unfortunately, that has to be the last question, because we also have the book signing to look forward to. But I cannot thank you enough for your book, for engaging with me. This is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, yes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.